It's time for Caffeinated Comics, a lively discussion and debate on comics, film, television, and collectibles, all fueled by the magic of Frappuccinos. Caffeinated Comics is sponsored by Chimeras Comics. Chimeras is your one stop for comic books, graphic novels, hero clicks, Magic the Gathering, and more. Explore the fantastic at Chimeras Comics. And now, here's your hosts, John and Steven.
Thank you, it's Caffeinated Comics. I'm your host, John Clark. Kelly Jones is here. Kelly Jones is one of the most influential Batman artists of the 90s, and recently he has relaunched Swamp Thing with the Swamp Thing creator, Len Wein. There was so much to talk about, both Batman and Sandman and Swamp Thing, and Kelly just gets right into it, so let's let him talk.
You know, I'm a fan of the book since, oh, I think issue two.
Of the original Bernie Wrightson.
Of the original series. And so it had always been around. It was something, like I said, had a personal importance to me. And then the fact that it has, the last year or so, kind of happened the way, you know, everything's happened the way it has, is, you know, personally, again, amazing. The fact that it has kind of caught on is surprising, but I'm happy, but it's just kind of surprising.
Right. Well, when you say it happened the way it has, what do you mean? Because we had a run that ended not that long ago.
Well, I mean, I guess for me, it's just, it was a character I was always a fan of. So for the chance for me to get to draw it is just one of those. I mean, it was as strange as getting Batman to do, you know?
Right. And you did draw Swamp Thing during your Batman run.
Yeah, I begged to do him. At that time, Vertigo and the DCU kind of had a understanding that they didn't share characters. And I didn't know that. But I had done Deadman and Sandman and whatnot, and drawn an issue of Swamp Thing. And so I didn't know that. And when I had asked, they, you know, when just talking about what to do, I had always loved issue 7 of Swamp Thing with Batman in it. And I thought it would be cool to return the favor. And that's when they had told me, well, we don't share characters right now. And so I called Karen Berger and begged her and said, can we just, whatever it would take to do, I'll do it. And she wonderfully just said, no, go ahead. You know, that's great. You know the character. You respect it. I trust those guys. Go ahead and have fun.
Yeah, I remember that at the time there were press releases saying, like, this is not going to happen again.
Yeah, it was more of a personal favor to me. So I always appreciated it. And, you know, at that point I said, I'm not going to ask for anything, you know, I won't do that again. But, you know, that wasn't too much. I mean, I think it was the next issue I wanted to do Mr. Freeze, or 525, I think I wanted to do Mr. Freeze. And they said, well, we don't do Mr. Freeze. And, you know, I begged and begged. And they said, we just gave you Swamp Thing. And I said, I really want to do Mr. Freeze. So
what was the embargo on Mr. Freeze? Because
they didn't care for the character in-house at that time. They thought he was a silly character. That's why I redesigned him. I said, no, he can be a really frightening character and a perfect Rogues Gallery character.
And this was after he was already in the animated series, wasn't it?
He was in the animated series, but that was, as far as they were concerned, well, that's the animated series. So I, at that point, didn't know any of this stuff. I'm really ignorant when I come to books. I'm a fan of a books. I just don't know all the lore. I don't know the politics of things. So I just love Mr. Freeze. I thought the idea of a character freezing people to death was pretty horrible. So I just wanted to do him, you know, and I redesigned him and put it forward. So it went from a two issue. They said, they didn't want to do two issues. Just you could do one. So that's why there was the one shot, but I was grateful for it. And as it turned out, they, at that point, that issue went over very well. They recast and redesigned the movie and then allowed, other people other writers and artists at DC to use Mr. Freeze, and he came back.
Yeah, that's amazing. I didn't realize that they had that embargo with Mr. Freeze.
I think it was just they saw him as a like from the old TV show, kind of silly.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I do remember at the time that Joker had killed him off in one panel in a Chuck Dixon Robin issue, and there was an issue, a Grant Morrison issue of Animal Man, where he was walking through the land of discarded characters, and Mr. Freeze was there going, "I used to fight Batman. Why does no one remember me?"
Yeah.
So but I had always assumed that once Heart of Ice had premiered, everybody turned around on the character. But it took some time there.
It did. For me, like I said, I think being blissfully ignorant of a lot of these things, I just go in and go, well, I like the idea of a character. I didn't base it on there was a story or a thing I saw that made me love Mr. Freeze. I just, in going through it, I wanted something kind of different to do. And I thought the idea of him doing how he went about his business by freezing people played up to my horror sensibility. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, and with a redesign, he could, you know, sometimes taking something old and not changing it radically, but just kind of seeing what the potential is can bring new life to a character.
Right. Yeah, that's great. That is really, really cool. Now, you mentioned your horror sensibility. As long as I've seen your work, and I think the first thing I ever saw you work on was your issues of Sandman.
Yeah.
It seems like you're an artist who's had a style kind of completely crystallized very early. How long did it take you to really start to craft kind of that style, which is so steeped in gothic and horror?
Well, I think it took a few years, not so much in pursuing that style. It's that I was not, as much as I love comics, my influences was much more cinematic. I was a much bigger film fan than one of just doing comic art or art. I mean, a lot of artist friends of mine, they know everything that happened within a comic book creator's past and whatnot. I just know the stuff I liked and I didn't. But for me, I came from taking a lot of film courses, and that's where my style really, that's what I wanted to do, was bring, for example, with Batman, more of a film noir, gothic approach than anything that had really happened in comics too much before. I remember being very much taken with Orson Welles at that time, and in particular his black and white films, which is pretty much all the great ones. And I just really thought that would work for Batman, because beyond the action in a story, you could get really good imagery. You could really set an atmosphere. I wanted Gotham to be a character, and really this odd place that makes these strange people. And having seen Orson Welles' films, it just seemed to, well, I could use that. And from there, you kind of solve your own problems and a style develops. Not so much intending to get a style. It just sort of happens.
So would you say you were kind of leaning towards your strengths? Because I do see a lot of, like, of Citizen Kane and even Magnificent Ambersons in a lot of your panel composition. But also the gothic is so heightened. Were you drawn to, like, the Hammer films?
Well, I loved Hammer films, and I loved Universal films. And those things are always going to be there because they set an atmosphere. So when you got to a moment, the big payoff moments, you were kind of ready for it. And I've wanted Batman to feel like a Batman comic, whether he was on a panel or not, in a page or not. I also wanted it to be where when somebody came to what I was doing, they would know I did it. Whether they saw a signature or not, they would know I did it. And that would help, I think, be more fair to fans. Doug wrote them to where they were kind of standalone stories, and I drew them kind of following suit to what he was doing. And then that way, you know, you didn't have to buy Robin and Detective and all the others if you didn't want to. Consequently, if you didn't like us, you weren't missing anything. It wouldn't screw up you reading all the other books, which were at that time all tied together.
Right. Yeah, there was a really interesting time in the 90s, and I've talked to both Chuck Dixon and Graham Nolan about this, who were doing Detective while you and Doug were doing Batman. And the way it seemed like the way Denny ran it was everything had its own flavor, but it still existed in the same universe. So it would only be those crossovers once or twice a year where the books would come together.
Right.
But it seemed like he focused on getting you guys to do the strongest book you can in the style you wanted to do it.
Well, he hired you and he would say, now go do your thing.
Right. And now,
and don't worry about how it's received. That's our job. Our job is to put you forward. It was a very liberating kind of order to give. Now, I was already, you know, I was in shock that they would even hire me to do Batman on the monthly. I had been doing him in Elseworlds and whatnot, but it was something I just simply wasn't going to say no to, even though it meant, you know, basically you're going to prison, you know, because that's all you're going to do until you're not doing it. And I really think if you're going to do comics, if you get a shot to take a main character and you can get 2-3 years on it, you take it. That's what we're here for.
Yeah. And it was interesting. You kind of backed into the monthly almost in the opposite direction you'd expect an artist's career to do, because you were doing these prestige formats like Red Rain, the vampire books, and then you were doing just the covers during Nightfall, and then you took over the monthly.
Normally you'd write. You would work towards getting to the hardcover graphic novels and stuff. The covers came about in that DC was interested in hiring Sam Keith to do covers for them. And they knew that I knew him through back channel. And they couldn't get a hold of him. So they said, can you get a hold of him? We'd like him to do this. And I said, sure. And I highly recommended him. I had said, you're going to get great stuff and it will be completely awesome. And I really, because they were thinking of just like one or two covers, something like that. I said, no, you got to get him for a run. It'll be awesome. And so I called Sam. They spoke and he agreed to do it. And for whatever reason, and this happens to, it's happened to me before and it happened to him. He just kind of froze on it. And
he did do a few.
He did a couple, but he called me one day and just said, I'm really not comfortable with this. I don't know what's wrong. Because, you know, as it turns out, he does a great Batman.
Yeah.
But at that time, it just, it might have been because he was doing, we had done a Hulk together and we had worked together before. We've known each other since high school. And so at that point, DC was calling me saying, you know, he's late. Can you tell us what's going on? And I would talk to Sam. Sam said, don't worry, I'll do it. Well, as it turned out, he couldn't do it. And so at that point, DC said, fine. But they got a hold of me and they said, look, you vouched for him. It's almost like, you know, the mafia. You vouched for him. We need, you know, 5 or 6 covers here in the next week and a half. You have to do them. So it wasn't like I was hired to do it. So at that point, I stopped what I was doing and I went from there. And I drew, penciled and inked these covers at that, you know, thinking that would be it. That I would do these 5 or 6 covers and that would be it.
Yeah, that you were just covering for your friend. And then
right. And they basically were saying if I did that, it would be no harm, no foul. And I said, okay. Because I explained to him, I said, look, I've had that happen to me where you get a character that you always wanted. And they understood that. They were totally fine with it. It's just I had to, you know, they needed these covers. So I did them. And lo and behold, they worked out fine. They got when DC got them, they really, really liked them. The first few came out and were very well received, and then it just sort of happened from there. Then they would say, well, you know, how would you like to do the covers for Batman and Detective, just to keep, just, you know, and then they were starting Nightfall and all that stuff. Well, that was fine because that really didn't eat into my schedule too much doing, I was, you know, doing the graphic novel work. And so I said, sure, fine. And it just worked from there. When that finally, I'd been doing it for a couple of years and I was frankly tired of it. That's when they said, well, then how would you like to do the monthly? And I was not expecting that. And when that call came, I immediately said yes. And that was because some years earlier, I had met with the artist Doug Wildey, who had done Johnny Quest. Mm-hmm. And he had told me he'd seen a job of mine, an Aliens job I had done, and he'd really quite liked it. So he'd asked if at a convention if I would sit and have a cup of coffee with him. He just wanted to ask me about how I came to do that, because he did like it quite a bit. So we were talking a little bit, and he says, you know, this is really good. How long did it take you to do this? And I told him whatever the time frame was. He says, well, you know, the only way you're really, really going to get good is if you do like 3 years on something, on a monthly book, and you have to be as good on the last issue you do as the first issue. And through that fear and pressure and deadline, you'll learn to be a good artist, a good comic book artist, beyond just whatever talent you have. And that stuck in my head. So a few years later, when Denny O'Neill called, that was the first thing that came to mind. And I said, sure. And at the time, I was working with Doug Minch, and he was not too happy about that. He wanted to keep continuing doing the specials and the graphic novels. But I told him this, and he says, okay, fine. If that's your decision, then I'm going to write these stories, the stories I've always wanted to write, and you got to promise you're always going to be on time, or I'm going to break your neck.
Yeah, because Doug had already done a run on Batman.
Right.
About 10 years before. And was it that you two had gotten along really well doing the Batman Vampires? That
yeah, and I think what it was is we had the same sensibility on stuff, and he, but he had always wanted to write, if you know, his Batmans with me were different than the other ones he had done.
Yeah, the tone that he was writing in the early to mid 80s. Was much less horror based than when he was working with you, and that's one of the things I wanted to know was that your influence, or was that basically what
I think what he
was?
Did was he wanted to write to his you know, he had this kind of paranoid view of things, conspiracy view of things, and he would throw that in. He liked the horror characters, and he asked me that, and I had told him at that point, you write it, I'll draw it. And we would discuss a few things, but for the most part, those were the things he wanted to do. He would say, what character would you like to do? I'd say Scarecrow or something, or like we were saying earlier, Swamp Thing or Mr. Freeze or something. But he would come up with these isolated stories, not connected to anything else, and they really kind of took off. Because you didn't have to read everything else. You didn't even have to know what had happened. You could come into the middle of our run or whatever, and they were standalone. And Doug really enjoyed that. The kind of short story nature of those books have made them, oddly enough, not dated.
Right, and there wasn't a lot of it going on at that time.
Not at all. 90s. It's the last time it had happened, too. It's the last time. So we kind of knew that at the point. And we were to continue to a fourth year. And that was going to be our last year anyway, or my last year. And we, but at that point, when they had sent the contract for the fourth season, one of the stipulations was that we had to be connected up. And I just didn't feel I would help anybody very much. You know, I didn't think that if the other guys were doing parts 1 and 5 and I was doing part 3, it wasn't, I always felt very, I didn't look like the other guys too much. And I felt it would shock people or it would be too distracting.
Did you have a hard time doing it? Because I know you did some of them. Like
The ones that it didn't, where it was okay was when they would say something's going on. I think Contagion was one. And basically Doug wrote it as a standalone within the context of what they were doing.
Right. It took the premise of the crossover, but it was a self-contained chapter.
Yeah. I mean, he still kept them. So if you were to read it, you didn't need to know what was going on. You would just think that people got sick in Gotham in that particular issue. And then you moved on. And on the ones where they were like saying, no, you have to do it, I just would beg off. And I would go and do, you know, Doug would write stuff for me while they would do that. And I think there was a couple, Jim Aparo drew a couple at that time. I mean, they would always say, do you want to do it? But I think something good was happening that Doug, John, and I had this kind of, I just knew it was the last of something going on. It was comics the way I remembered them. And so I just figured, you know what, one day when it's all said and done, somebody can read these. At that time, I didn't know how many would be, but as it turned out, 36 issues. And they would, for good or bad, they'd be different. You know, you'd remember them. Like it or not, they would be their own thing. And knock on wood, it worked out good.
Right, and now there's a collection of, I think it's, is it the first year in hardcover?
Yeah, they did. I think through first 10 or 12 issues, something like that. I think it's something like that. And then that has done surprisingly well. They did good business on that. So I know a second volume is coming out. I just don't know what their publishing schedule is. I know they like to give a little time between some of those things.
Right. Yeah. They tend to be once a year.
Yeah. So, and it depends on all the other stuff they're publishing as well.
Right. They've done a really good job with the hardcovers. I think the Legends of the Dark Knight run.
Yep.
They've gotten a lot of the early apparel, Brave and the Bold's out, and Marshall Rogers run, and Alan.
Well,
Davis
that was
and,
see that's the thing was I was very honored that they would do that.
Yeah.
So it I didn't think I would be as really affected by that. I tended to always think that, well, you know, if people want it had a cult status to it, even though it was, you know, a mainstream big time book and everything.
It was Batman. It wasn't like there was a new series created.
But what we were doing was very cultish, and it had a life of its own, and it was like the right people knew. And so when they had got a hold of me to say they're going to reprint this, it didn't really hit me until I was holding the book that you are a part of this history. I always respected it. I mean, it's like playing for the New York Yankees, you know? You play baseball and you're on a team, but then the Yankees say you get to play for them. And then you realize all the people that ever played for them. And it was kind of like that. I mean, you're thinking, you know, Sprang and Robinson and Adams and Rogers and all the great people who've ever done it. And then you get to be one. So the fact that it has stood out alongside those guys was so much more than I could ever hope for. You just are happy to have the job, much less 20 years later, there's a legacy to it. You know, that's just, you can't plan on that. And I still, if I think about it too much, it'll get to me.
So it's kind of like that hardcover book is your star on the Batman Walk of Fame.
It's odd. Because you set out to make yourself happy, I think. At least I do. I set out to enjoy myself while I do it that particular day. Avoid work, as it were, real work. So anything extra is just, I don't think in those terms. That's for other people to get. And so when that came out, I guess it's just, you know, something tangible you hold that's like, this did matter after all.
Now, as you're saying, the story you remember was to get really good, you need to spend 3 years on a run. What did you learn from doing Batman month in, month out, and having to get 20 pages done rather than spending the amount of time it took to do a hardcover format?
There's for a monthly, the first thing you do is realize you try not to repeat yourself. So you have to come up with fresh and interesting images for each month. You also have to get that book done within about 3 weeks. So you give everyone else time to properly do their job. It is not something where you don't say, well, I'm going to be in the mood to do it today. You have to get 6 pages done that week. If you get more done, that's great. The minimum had to be 6 pages. And however you do it, you do it. And some days you just got to eat it. If it isn't working, you got to eat it. And if it is working, that's a wonderful, magical thing. You get a good inker with you. I was lucky in having John Beatty, and he could cover up a lot of whatever I was blowing it on that day. But if I nailed something, he would make sure that made it through the inking process. Good stories didn't hurt. I mean, it sounds like I'm complimenting them all, but they earned it. It was a good team. It was a great team.
Yeah, and your style, speaking of John Beatty, your style was so based in so much black. Were you filling that in, or were you leaving negative space for him to fill
in? Well, a lot of it is compositional, and I always see black as a color. So I would want the colorist to be, I still, to this day, I would always ask colors to just work in a very primary palette and not think of the black as a color. And for Batman, it worked very well. And also the fact that a lot of it was composition and motion. I wanted a lot of the compositions to all individual panels to really stand out. I wanted to use that heavy graphic line to point to what I wanted you to look at, and all these kind of things. And I didn't want to leave it all up to a colorist. I didn't want a coloring book looking comic. I wanted it to look, actually, if they published it in black and white, I wanted people to go, wow, that works too.
And yeah, and with that, that's a perfect character to stand out in black and white.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Iron Man, I wouldn't do that, but Batman, I would.
Right. Now, it's speaking of composition and your eye leading through the page, Batman's cape has a really unique look to you. In fact, the whole design of Batman, I was just going through the run. I have your whole run in single issues. And my 8-year-old was looking at him. He's a huge Batman fan, but he's not at the point now where he knows artists.
Right.
And so I was showing him the covers, and he kept saying, "Why are his ears so long? Why are his fingers like that?" And again, going back to what we said before, to me as a reader, it seemed like that was your design of Batman was perfectly crafted. The Batman that I saw in Red Rain was very much the Batman I saw in your last monthly issue, or even in Batman Unseen,
right,
the later limited series you got. But it's very unique, and it's not your take on a Neil Adams Batman.
No,
how did that character come together?
Well, I always, I always tell people when they say that, I go, well, I didn't invent the long ears. I give Marshall Rogers a lot of credit for that.
Yeah, but I think your ears take the prize of longest
years. I always think of him this way. I think of Gotham, like I said earlier, is the main character. And Gotham makes these crazy people, and generally it's a dangerous city. It's kind of Shirley Jackson's Hill House is where I got the idea of it. Was just Gotham's a born bad place. Mm-hmm. And the anomaly to Gotham to me was Batman. That here's this hero comes out of it, who could easily be the most dangerous of all the villains if he chose to be. So I always thought that how does he not just go after the rogues gallery, but just the regular criminal element of Gotham. And to me, it's intimidation and it's terror. And it's that he does, his real power are those things. So he has to look the part. I mean, the regular people of Gotham don't know if he's a hero or a villain. They see the bat signal as a warning light, not a call to aid. You don't know if he's in the room with you or not while you're contemplating or planning crimes. And so when he appears, he's got to look like somebody you don't even want to mess with. That's why the more realistic he looked, the more confrontable he was to me. With the swirling cape and the demonic ears and the whole nature of how he holds himself, that kind of says don't, you know, it's like in nature, it would say don't mess with this, it's dangerous, you know. And it just sort of took a life of its own.
They're kind of a feral animal.
Of complete vengeance for justice, yes. But people don't know that. Some criminals would, some wouldn't. They just know. I mean, they just know you don't mess with him. If he says stop it, you stop it. The crazies are the ones who fight him.
Now that makes a lot of sense.
It was sometimes you just need an angle, and so when I would draw him, that was always the angle that he was. As Bruce Wayne, he wouldn't do that. Bruce Wayne was regular party guy or whatever. But when he was Batman, he was something you did not cross.
Yeah, I find it interesting that you're surprised that it's remembered, because that design of Batman, I feel like, is what I go back to every time. I know the gothic look of Gotham is something that strikes out, the use of black, the compositions of individual panels on the pages. But your style of Batman, I remember being celebrated at the time, was when Kenner still had the license, there was an action figure of your Batman while you were still drawing it. There's a black and white statue out now.
Yep. Look, I think what it is I was so close to it, I didn't see it. I have not to this day, and I don't say it of false humility, I see myself as a fan who got lucky and gets to draw comic books. I'm never as a professional. I never took any formal art training. So I would read Batman comics I loved, and those guys are professionals. So when I did it, I was so close to it, I didn't see. I would love to say I planned all this, but a lot of this was just, how do you do it today? How do I make it work? Just today, how do I make it work? And then it sort of evolved from there. Partly, you can look at other people. Marshall Rogers was a huge influence on me, mm-hmm. because I think the atmosphere of his books just really felt right. Obviously, I did things a lot different than him, but I always wanted that same atmosphere. Or at least create one that people would know that, when I was doing Batman, it felt like a Batman comic. It didn't feel like I wasn't a guy who was just drawing Captain America, but with a cape. So that all worked. But like I said, it was so close to it. It wasn't until I went away from it and did other things that someone would bring it to you to sign. I don't sit around and look at my own stuff. So in fact, it would be several years until I even looked at any of the art again. And that was, I went to a show and they bring you some books to sign. And I went, wow, this looks really different. I was thinking that. And I was happy. It was like, I was just really, really pleased with how they looked. I can't control what the general reaction is, but I was, for me, I was like going, I can live with this.
Well, speaking of your perspective of being a fan, I definitely want to talk about the new Swamp Thing series you're doing.
Sure.
I was looking at issue one today, and I noticed your Swamp Thing felt different than it did in your Batman story. And it almost seemed to me, and you can tell me if I'm off, it almost seemed to me to be closer to Bernie Wrightson's design.
Absolutely.
Than what you had done before. What you had done before was a little closer to the Alan Moore, Steve Bissett version. Was that a deliberate take because you're working with Len Wein?
Well, part of it was when I did it in Batman, that was the way the character looked. And that's how he was. When Len, with what Len's doing, he wanted to return it to a horror title. And I'm an artist. I'm a comic book, doing comic books because of basically Bernie Wrightson Swamp Thing. I like comics and I like to draw, but I never thought of ever drawing comic books for myself or just for fun, even as a kid, until I came across that second issue of Swamp Thing, which I did not like when I first saw it because it was so different than everything else.
Was it, and then the was second it when it time, came out? Or
I got it. I don't know. It has to have been right around that time. I was a kid then. It was right around that time. And I remember the parents of the kid who had them. They didn't want him reading those kind of things, which instantly made it attractive to me. But my folks didn't mind me having comic books. That was fine. And I read all the other comics in there, and there was some terrific superhero stuff and whatnot. But in there was Swamp Thing 2. And at that time, Swamp Thing was only on issue 4 or 5. So I was able to get them all. But I remember just being electrified by it. The first time I read it, I did not like it. It was very upsetting. It was a frightening book.
Yeah, it Bernie's original stuff intended to take that EC style and push it even
well.
Further.
The Unmen. I think it was just the Unmen, and that I even as a kid picked up that Swamp Thing was Frankenstein, and it really worked, and so I just became really enamored of it. And then, you know, when Len said this is what it's going to be as a horror title, and Swamp Thing's kind of had a tough go of it, just in that it got so convoluted it was hard for new people to come on board. It was hard for people who knew it was, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think people were living in that shadow of Alan Moore.
Yeah, and
which is a dense read.
It is, and you can't do that.
Now I feel like Swamp Thing is kind of falling into the same trap that Daredevil fell into for a long time after Frank Miller. Is one person's put such a stamp on that.
Yep.
Is that everybody just wants it to be that now.
Right.
Which
so,
is not the original even incarnation of that character.
No, and it was like with Batman, I thought of film noir type of an angle. With what Len was wanting to do, doing horror, and making that be what the book is principally. That's the what it's about. That's the atmosphere. I at that point said, all right. And then I didn't want to directly do Bernie because that's Bernie. And I love that. So you kind of just come up with, you know, the happy medium as it were. And luckily it's worked out for me. I see for me when I'm drawing him, I always think of him as, you know, the vines and the roots and whatever, but they're moving. They're not static. They aren't like a muscle or a joint that just stays still. They're moving constantly as he stands there. And that's particularly, at least for me, that's creepy. So I draw him fundamentally the same size and shape, but these things are moving on him. So somewhere in between the two, not really, but it's kind of, as I've been doing it, taking a life of its own. I've done 3 issues of it now, and I'm very pleased with the atmosphere that Len has been able to write, and I've been, hopefully, knock on wood, been capturing it. But it's been a delightful book, and I am very, very happy with Len's writing.
Yeah, it's got to be... Well, it's got to be daunting too.
Well, it's fun. I mean, what it is he wrote a fun book. I think that's rare. I think he's getting right to it. He's telling you a story. There's narration boxes. You know, there's actual exposition. He's actually telling you what's going on rather than you have to guess. Mm-hmm. He's not trying to reinvent the wheel. And that's where it's connected. Look, I'm surprised it sold out as fast as it did. That I will say. I hoped it would be well received, but I didn't expect that. And it made me feel good, not so much on a personal level, but just that, boy, books like this can work.
Well, when done right.
Yeah, and that's the trick. I've read Graham Engels and Wally Wood and Wrightson and everybody else doing those kind of things. And I always wondered, would it still work? And again, I work very closely with Michelle Mattson, the colorist. And I don't tell her what to do. I always just say kind of what I said earlier, primary palette. I like my lighting like an old episode of the first season of Star Trek. Hmm. And
very harsh color gels and
yes, because and if you notice the shadows and the blacks in Star Trek are black, mm-hmm. and they're heavy.
What's that whole that 60s when they're just yeah, but color they're trying to use every color as much as possible.
Well, and it pops.
Yeah,
and it just pops. Now for me, I'm working against. There's such good production now. I'm trying to work against it. It's like a musician. I want distortion on my guitar leads. Mm-hmm. You know. I don't want it perfect. I want this roughness. And the only way to do it is to not knock out the blacks, not to do lots of flares, not to do the things that it's capable of doing, but just letting the art speak for itself. And in doing so, it allows the story to unfold better. I think the atmosphere that Lynn's wanting, we're getting that. Because we're not trying to, you know, the swamp looks like a swamp. And it's, I can't imagine Michelle, I mean, I can't speak for her, but I can't see it taking her that long to color it. Because she's not having to do all this extraordinary amount of extra effort. All she has to do is make each panel work. And I try to set her up for that. But I think that's why it works. If you go back and look, there are no knocked out blacks.
Well, I think it's even more than having a distorted guitar, to use the music analogy, you're making a punk album.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that. I would say that. I want it. It's very, look, I just use a brush, a number two pencil and an eraser. I don't use Photoshop. I don't even want to. Everything I do physically. And I think my biggest special effect is I put ink on my thumb and smear it.
So you're inking this one yourself?
Yeah.
Does that change your process much than working with John Beatty?
Only in the sense that there are certain areas that I don't have to pencil because I know I'm going to draw with the brush. Other areas I still like to draw it because I want to control the composition. I want it very tight. It can go faster. Some days where I may go faster on pencils, I'll go longer on inks. Because I'll be doing certain. I spent a long day the other day on a page just to get these black and white effects, and hopefully they'll come out through production and coloring and all that. I don't know. In black and white, it looked good, but that doesn't always mean it will in a finished, produced comic book.
Right. And as you said, you're not, unlike the way Len and Bernie did it, you're not producing it on this heavy newsprint, which has got kind of a tint to it, and it sucks up the ink. It's much more shiny and glossy.
Oh, I love the old newsprint. I'd give anything for that paper. It had a great evening effect. It's like a Technicolor. Mm-hmm. It really did work. I think you can see sometimes when they try to reprint older comics, they make the mistake of coloring like they're new comics.
Right. Yeah, and there's sometimes they just get too bright.
They don't work. And one of the nice things I saw recently, maybe they're addressing it, I don't know, but I saw them reprint the Scarecrow stories I did during my Batman run and they were on a paper that was, I don't want to say it wasn't a newsprint, but it was a, and I don't even want to say lesser grade, but it wasn't this shiny paper and it wasn't recolored and it looked fabulous.
Right. Yeah. The DC will do that now and then. I remember when they reprinted all of Jack Kirby's Fourth World in hardcovers. Yeah. It was a much heavier stock than the old newsprint, but it was still that kind of that matte finish, that almost like cloth feel to it. You could tell it was soaking up that ink.
Oh, it's beautiful. I think a lot of artists are forced to almost go just, I don't want to say coloring book because that sounds wrong, but they allow for a lot more color and production work being done because heavy blacks tend to lose something. I work very hard in rendering into them. I work into composition so much that I can hold an image, but I have to have the colorist work with me on that. And I find a primary palette, you can achieve some pretty cool effects, and still have not the comic book look like, you know, it doesn't, you know, it still would work today.
Right.
So I try to take advantage of printing a lot of the good stuff they can do, and then I try to avoid, you know, falling into the pitfalls of some of the stuff I think doesn't work very well.
Right. Yeah, I think there was that shift really to the glossy paper. First of all, it seemed more high-end, and I remember it was when the industry was starting to take a downturn.
Yep.
This was a way to charge more for a comic and make you think there was more. And it was also at the time where computer coloring was coming in, so you started to have these flare effects and a lot more hues where the glossy paper was picking that up and reflecting it. But right, for the older material, it was never intended to be made like that.
Well, you can work on glossy paper if you, in the old days, they used to do a thing called blue lining. So when I did Dead Man with Les Dorscheid or Red Rain with Les Dorscheid, he would get the artwork to color. And it would be on a, they would print the page in blue, and he would color it. And it would have a black acetate he'd put over it so he could, control it, and take a look and see where it's at. But he would literally watercolor each page. And a lot of amazing things came out of it. He, for example, with Dead Man, he made him go from, his head and shoulders were red, and as you went to his feet, it became purple. And this wonderful transition, and this the way he would he could really get across natural lighting as opposed to indoor lighting, and those things worked on the high glossy paper. They were fine because somebody was hand watercoloring. I think when we go to computer and stuff like that, it can be almost like rather than a really nice lighting that you'd get natural lighting. It's almost like supermarket kind of, you know, the lighting's just really glary and you don't really get a solid black. Doesn't mean the books won't look good. It just means they're hard. It's harder to do horror. It's harder to do that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, horror can't ever be too glossy. I was, watching this documentary about VHS tapes, and there were fans of VHS tapes that said they will not watch a horror movie on Blu-ray.
I still have my VHS collection, and I can see where they're coming from. It's the same as vinyl records as opposed to a CD. And it isn't that you're a Luddite and you don't like the new technology. I buy Blu-rays, but I can see what they mean. The blacks are black. I love what you get, a certain grit to it. And, you know, it's hard to tell people, hey, you like this. It's low tech. They won't, you know, they'll think there's something wrong.
Well, and horror, especially, there's the harder it is to see.
Yep.
The scarier it is.
Well, sometimes I intend my backgrounds to blend with my foregrounds.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I intend my shadows to be, you can't really make out what's in there. I mean, in a comic book, it's an image people can stare at. it's not a moving image. So I have to make sure that I really set up that image that when you get to it, it pays off.
Yeah.
And that's the game.
Well, we've been rewatching a lot of X-Files to get ready for this new season.
Right.
And I forgot how dark that show was.
Yes, it was.
There are shots where it's you're seeing one cheek of David Duchovny and nothing else. And you know, The Walking Dead would never do that. Everything is pure and clear as day.
Yeah, and
not to say one show is better than the other, but
no, I think I prefer the former to the latter in that sense, if that's what you mean. I mean, just in the visual, not show to show. One of the things I enjoyed about Len's scripts have been that they are very well paced and they're very well set up, that when he gets to a point, he spent his time building to that point. A lot happens in a Len Wein written comic book, which is nice. I mean, for me, they cost a lot of money. A lot better happened in the book, you know, a lot of good stuff. He doesn't just wait to get to the end to tell you something. So as an artist, especially doing horror, I appreciate that. I look for a lot of little moments to set up for the big moment.
These six issues are one story, right?
They're sort of, the first two issues kind of tell a small story, mm-hmm, to set you up for the larger. And that, again, pretty organic, and I like that. And it makes, at least when I'm reading them, it makes an unsettling tone to it. You don't know what's going to happen. It doesn't have the normal rhythm. So that in and of itself is good for horror.
Right, because it keeps you out of your comfort zone.
Yeah, because you think, you know, okay, what does this mean? But you know it means something. As opposed to, we don't know what we're doing. You know, and it just sort of happened.
Well, and since this is a six-issue story, it's not like you're doing the monthly. You know exactly where it's going. So are you?
Pretty much. I mean, if this does well, they're going to go regular with or grow monthly.
But you know where you'll be in issue six.
I pretty much know where we'll be. Yes. Okay. I know how. Yes. Of course, that doesn't mean there aren't wonderful little organic moments that will take place. But overall, yes. Mm-hmm.
Right,
so that gives me a chance to do a lot of foreshadowing and whatnot.
That was exactly my question. You're not getting it month to month and figuring out where Len's going.
No, I think what it is in the big picture, it's letting this character be rediscovered by old and new fans and trying to not make it like you need a textbook to follow it.
We were just having this discussion actually on last week's show.
Yeah.
We were talking about Star Wars, about how some of the criticism of the new J.J. Abrams film is that it's too similar to the original.
Yeah.
And I was saying you had to do that because the prequels were so different and went so far out that you had to kind of plant your flag right back in the beginning. And we were talking about how comics always have this swing. Of doing something different. Well, now that character is not that character anymore, and back to basics. And it seems like that's kind of what you've been doing after years of people trying to out Alan Moore.
Right.
Is that you're just trying to go, well.
Well, if you're going to do it, if you're going to do this and you have the opportunity to, the first thing you would do is get Len because he created it. And not just because he created it, but he did a pretty good run of setting that tone so that character could exist on until Alan did it.
Right. And Len's also been very busy his whole career, so it's not like a reunion tour.
No, not at all. In fact, the thing I like about it is it feels very fresh to me. When I read it, I wondered, you know, is this just going to be him you know, doing his take on that or what? No, it could have been issue 11 of Swamp Thing. Mm-hmm. And not that it's like, you know, where you feel like it's, see, I didn't feel it was, it felt very original to me. And, there was a lot of power in it because he was able to pare down and focus on Swamp Thing again, just as this character who doesn't want, you know, he's a guy who is a monster. That's still pretty good stuff. That's a, you can do a lot with that. And the fact that, as it gets into the series, that becomes a big center part, a center point to the whole thing, is being this thing. We enjoy reading it, but it wouldn't be fun being that guy. Mm-hmm. You know, again, it's the Frankenstein element, I guess.
Yeah, and speaking of enjoying it, it sounds like you're definitely enjoying drawing it.
It is one of those things where I knew it would be a pleasure, but getting to work with Len on Swamp Thing on a personal level, that's very strange. It's wonderful, but it's strange. You got to remember, I'm still that kid who got that box of comics.
Yeah.
And there was his name. And, you know, knowing Wrightson personally, it's just strange. I cannot put it any other way. Doing Batman was strange, but this is even weirder because Len and Bernie created this thing, and to know them personally and work with Len is pretty good, you know?
That's great. Well, I know that the book is out now.
Yep.
But how can people get in contact with you online? I know we've talked through Facebook.
Pretty much through Facebook. That's the easiest way to do it. It's a pretty busy life trying to pencil and ink a book like this. I mean, I'm at the same time, I've got a Batman thing coming up afterwards.
There's another limited series or?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
And
with Doug again?
No, that's, with, the writer's name is Scott Peterson. He was an editor mm-hmm. at DC during that time, and he had written Batman for some time. And so, but it's a Batman and Scarecrow story.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah, so that's lined up as well. But, you know, if this does well, who knows?
Thanks again to Kelly Jones for a great interview. You can follow me at Not In My Book on Twitter. That is the Caffeinated Comics official Twitter feed. You can like us on Facebook. That's where we post all our news. You can listen to us every week on iTunes, on Stitcher, or directly at caffeinatedcomics.blogspot.com, where you'll find all 160 episodes of the show that we've been doing for 3.5 years. If you'd like to visit Steven's shop and buy yourself Swamp Thing or the collected Batman or his volume of Sandman, you can see Steven at 19 South LaGrange Road in LaGrange, Illinois at Chimera's Comics. We'll talk to you next week.
Caffeinated Comics is a Not In My Book production.
Take that!